Hi, my name is Muna Morris Adams, and I'm the tutor for the methodology module on Aston's MSc in TESOL. Let me start by giving you a broad outline of what you can expect to hear in this introduction to the methodology module, which I'll refer to as MET for short. I'll briefly comment on the current state of methodology in English language teaching, another abbreviation there, ELT, and introduce the aims and perspectives of the module. I'll then take a closer look at some recent trends and influences. And after that, I'll talk about the MET module itself with a brief description of the content of the 10 units. As action research is a key component of professional development, I'll discuss this next before moving on to the module assessment. And I'll finish with some examples of assignments from participants to help put the action research element into perspective and to give you an idea on what's expected of you. And on the last slide, you will find a selection of references. So let's take a look at what's happening in the world of ELT methodology and start with what may be a slightly surprising question in this context. In what sense can we talk about the end of methodology? This question was asked by Mike Wallace 10 years ago, and many other researchers have also questioned the nature and role of ELT methodology. From Prabhu, who said, "There is no best method. Why?" to Kumara Vadivelu, who declared that we are now beyond methods, or at least in a post-method condition. I should point out here that Wallace draws a distinction between methods as a set of very specific classroom practices and methodology in a much broader sense, which includes approaches, techniques, and principles. And he says that while methods may be dead, there can be no end to methodology. He concludes that all effective methodology is in response to a social context, and that context is subject to a process of change at all levels, macro, micro, and individual. And for me, the two key words in this quote are those of context and change. Taking context first, it's the realization that what works in one social or cultural context will not necessarily work in another, which has resulted in all the questions being asked about the dominance of any one method to fit all teaching and learning situations. Holliday, in his influential book on appropriate methodology and social context, argues strongly for the need to take into account the social and educational realities of local contexts in the development and planning of the methodologies that to be employed in classrooms. Kumara Vadivelu proposed what he calls a macro-strategic framework in an attempt to encompass local realities and local educational environments. And the framework is based on the following three parameters for language teaching and learning. The first one of these he referred to as particularity. And this relates to the issues I've just touched on, namely to ensure that teaching and learning are relevant for particular groups of students in particular contexts. In other words, methods need to be adapted to fit in with local requirements and realities. And the second parameter is practicality, and this relates both to classroom practice and to theories of practice. Kumara Vadivelu's view is that no theory of practice can be fully useful and usable unless it is generated through practice. And this, of course, is a view that fits in very well with action research conducted by teachers. The third parameter is called possibility, and this has its roots in critical pedagogy and embraces sensitivity to issues of class, gender, and race as they may impact on language learning. He also outlines a number of specific macro strategies as guiding principles for teaching, but I'm not going to go into those here. The need to be responsive to and aware of local contexts underlies the notions of situated learning and of context-sensitive research, which feature so prominently in our own perceptions of professional development and of professional expertise. So a key aim of the module is to enable you to account for and to articulate your own personal methodology. By increasing your awareness and understanding of classroom choices and decisions, and also being able to link those decisions to theoretical positions, or indeed to formulate your own theoretical perspectives. The process of engaging with the readings and the tasks in the module and doing your research project may well lead you to question many established assumptions about methodology. And this, in turn, may lead you to make changes to your own teaching. If you want to read an entertaining account of the changes that have happened and are still happening in the world of ELT, there's a recent article by Alan Waters called A Guide to Methodologia, Past, Future and Present. And this draws attention to the various ideological and theoretical influences that have led to major changes in methodology. Let me expand a little on just three current and very different influences which may affect the future development of methodology, or which are already having an impact on how and what we teach. One of these I've already referred to briefly in connection with Kumara Vedivelu's three parameters, namely of critical pedagogy. Teaching can never be an entirely neutral activity. Our personal values and beliefs will inevitably affect our classroom behaviour, our teaching approaches, our relationships with learners, and possibly also the power relations which exist in classrooms. But we may also find ourselves affected by any number of external socio-political factors. One example might be the continued existence of very discriminatory employment practices in a lot of countries where only native speakers of English are likely to get jobs as English teachers. It might also be the case that national language policies may endanger certain local languages, and this again is something that might impact on our learners. There might in some places be unequal access to educational opportunities. So, critical pedagogy seeks to challenge social and political inequality and to encourage learners to become critical thinkers. And teaching is therefore seen as a process of transformative action. Whether or not we decide to engage with issues of inequality, for example, by discussing them with our learners, is of course an individual decision. But we need, I think, to be aware of the impact such issues may have on our learners. At a less political and more social level, let's take a look at a different influence that coming from socio-cultural theory. As the term implies, learning is seen not so much as an individual intellectual achievement, but as something which emerges from participating in social practices in specific cultural contexts. And learning is therefore seen very much as a collaborative activity. This particular perspective is associated primarily with the work of Vygotsky, a Russian psychologist, who saw language as an important tool to mediate social learning and mental development. And two key concepts related to this theory are those of the zone of proximal development and the notion of scaffolding. And the zone of proximal development was defined by Vygotsky as the distinction between the actual developmental level, as determined by independent problem solving, and the level of potential development, as determined through problem solving under adult guidance or in collaboration with more capable peers. So the process of giving guidance or assistance then becomes what's known as scaffolding. It provides, in other words, the support which is needed for learning to take place. Although the theory applies to learning in general and not just to language learning, it's been embraced by language teachers and researchers because the emphasis on interaction and collaboration tie in with current communicative approaches. More often than not, it's the teacher who provides the scaffolding in language classes. But when learners work together in pairs or groups, the stronger learners may take on the role of providing assistance to help other learners with the task in hand, and therefore contribute to the learning process. And Stork comments on the usefulness of pair work and group work, and says that the act of teaching or explaining to others may help L2 learners construct a more coherent and clearer representation of their own L2 knowledge. So this sort of learning may take place during the interactions which learners engage in both inside and outside the classroom. And the last development I'll mention relates very much to language use outside the classroom. The continuing spread of English means that it's now spoken more often by so-called non-native than by native English speakers in context of intercultural communication. And very many users of English often employ local or non-standard varieties of English in intercultural interactions. So we get reference to type of language, if you like, that they might be using. And ELF is English as a lingua franca used by speakers who have different mother tongues. And EIL, English as an international language, again, will be used by speakers in international contexts. But also, I think the implication there is it recognises English as having the status of a major language for communication. And World Englishes recognises that different varieties of English is spoken, and that this is particularly the case, of course, in countries with a colonial background where English might very well be a second or an official language, as it is in countries like India or Nigeria. Whether the particular variety that's spoken is Asian English or Euro-English, research seems to indicate that there might may be certain typical regularities which speakers may have in common. My personal favourite is to discuss about, which I've heard used by learners from all corners of the globe. And this addition of redundant prepositions seems to be very much a common feature, and it's found consistently in ELF corpora, together with other features such as missing articles and the non-use of the third person present tense S, which as teachers you will all be familiar with. But I think it's important to realise that many of these features, when they're used by speakers of English, do not generally cause problems in communications outside of the classroom. They may in fact cause more problems for teachers who will naturally maybe see them as errors and will most likely attempt to correct them. But a key question raised by ELF researchers like Seidelhofer and Jenkins is whether in fact this is a sensible approach, or whether we should instead respect the rights of learners to, as Jenkins says, develop their own norms rather than continuing to defer to those of the so-called educated native speaker. And Kanagara takes the argument a step further and says that native speaker norms of identity and proficiency disempower learners with a sense of inadequacy, preventing local communities from developing their pedagogical and linguistic resources in their own terms. Whatever your personal position on these issues, there's a lot to be said, I think, for greater awareness about the existence of local varieties of English on the part of both teachers and learners. There are, of course, very many other developments which affect ELT methodology, not least the influence of the internet, which has contributed to the spread of English and which is also increasingly a useful resource in language teaching, as are other developments like the use of blogs, podcasts, and even mobile phones. And in several countries, there's now a tendency for children to start learning English at a very early age, even in some countries at preschool ages. And that, of course, will have an impact on methodology. Content and language integrated learning, CLIL for short, is where the foreign language is used in the instruction of other subjects, and that too is a tendency which is gaining ground. And furthermore, the impact of both native speaker and ELF corpora is something that is moving forward very rapidly, and many teachers are exploring how such corpora can be exploited in the classroom. So with all these developments, it's impossible to predict what the world of ELT will be like in another 10 or even in 5 years' time, and I'm not going to attempt it. Instead, I'm going to move on to talk about the units of the MET module. And given the discussion so far, it should come as no surprise that the guiding principle for this module, and indeed for the MSc programme as a whole, is based on what we've termed situated professional development, with an emphasis on participants investigating and reflecting on what happens in their own very specific teaching contexts. And this principle informs both the content and format of the MET module. Each unit contains a number of tasks which require participants to either read and reflect on their reading, or to discuss their thoughts, ideas, and opinions of the tasks with other participants on the virtual learning platform Blackboard, where we run discussion boards and module-specific study groups. So even if it's a distance learning course, there are plenty of opportunities for you to communicate with other participants and to share ideas on what you do in your classrooms and why. The materials of the MET module contain 10 units, and I'll give a brief description of them. And the first unit, which is called Methodology, Methods and Action Research, brings together some of the issues I've already talked about and looks in particular at the central role which action research can play in helping you to investigate your personal methodologies. And I'll talk a bit more about action research later on. The second unit is titled Communicative Language Teaching and looks at this approach, which is the current dominant paradigm in ELT, at least in the Western Hemisphere, and also looks at some of the changes which have affected and continue to affect the way in which it's implemented. The third unit on grammar teaching in the classroom explores the changing role which grammar teaching plays within communicative language teaching, the importance of grammar in second language acquisition, and ways in which grammar teaching can be implemented in the classroom. The focus here is on the concepts of consciousness raising and noticing, The idea being that conscious awareness and knowledge of the rules and structures of a language are thought to facilitate acquisition. But in contrast to more traditional approaches where teachers explained the rules, the emphasis has now moved to activities which encourage learners to deduce the rules for themselves, and in particular to notice any gaps which exist between their own productions of the target language and what would be considered grammatically or lexically more accurate or appropriate. And Unit 4 on phonology and discourse intonation makes some links between noticing grammar and intonation and explores them in some detail, particularly in connection with Brazil's discourse intonation model, which relates interactional significance of intonation to lexicographical features. And how much and how little we focus on pronunciation issues generally in our classrooms will naturally depend on the contexts in which we work and on our learners' current and future needs. We may want to consider carefully the appropriacy of the models of pronunciation which are being taught. In the context of English as an international language, it can no longer be assumed that learners will necessarily use what they've learned to communicate with native speakers, or even that they will use it in a target language setting. It is in fact much more likely that they will be using it in communication with other non-native speakers. And where this is the case, there may not be any need for them to conform entirely to the norms of pronunciation of native speakers. And the aim of pronunciation work may then be primarily to help learners develop intelligible pronunciation rather than necessarily native-like perfection. But, of course, we have to balance that with what learners may want, and that is, I think, in many cases, they want to sound like native speakers. Moving on to Unit 5, which is on task-based teaching, interaction and integration. And TBL, as it's often referred to, is of course one of the major innovative trends in methodological approaches. And this unit looks at what we mean by task and the many interpretations of the term, and how group work, which is quite often a prominent feature of TBL, can promote the students' participation in meaning-focused activities. This doesn't mean, as many people think, that grammar has no place in a TBL framework. One issue, though, is where in a task-based cycle a grammar focus is best placed, and what sort of form on focus activities might be most effective. TBL lends itself well to an integrated approach to the teaching of the different language skills, and an integrated approach is increasingly favoured by many teachers. And it's worth bearing this in mind when you come to read the four units which deal separately with the skills of reading, listening, speaking and writing. And the first of the units on teaching the language skills is Unit 6, called Readers. And it explores what makes a successful second language reader, what enables a learner to get to grips with the text, which strategies are most likely to be effective. And it discusses ways in which readers process textual materials and considers in some detail the psycholinguistic model of the reading process and schema theory. And from a practical classroom perspective, you will find some alternatives to the standard comprehension questions, which are such a feature of reading lessons. Unit 7 on listeners also features schema theory in a discussion of variously a top-down and bottom-up approach to the development of listening skills. And it also looks at the micro-skills involved and considers some of the practical issues we need to take into account when planning for the effective classroom teaching of the skill of listening, such as the selection of appropriate texts. and tasks. And we then move on to speaking. And both the unit on listening and speaking contains some discussion of the nature of the spoken language, because of course that is a key consideration in terms of what we expect, the types of discourses that we expect our learners both to listen to and to participate in. And this also involves discussion of what might be termed spoken grammar, which of course is quite often very different from what is found in writing. And in the context of the classroom, you will then come across questions like, not here, you won't. But we'll move on in that case to writers, and this unit examines different aspects of the writing process as well as the different approaches we can employ to teaching this skill. And it also looks at the type of correction or feedback we can provide to learners to help them develop their writing skills. And the final unit is called ESP Applications. And chances are that many of you will be teaching in context where the learners will have very specific language needs, whether it's for academic or vocational purposes. And you may then have to teach them how to cope with specific types of texts, for example, in the field of engineering, or with the specialised vocabulary of banking, or as some of our tutors have done, practice the clear communication skills needed by airline pilots. And this unit provides some examples of methodological responses to ESP contexts and considers whether or not we can in fact talk about a specific methodology for ESP. So all the topics in the module offer plenty of scope for asking questions about methodological issues and for researching possible answers. In the context of speaking, you might, for example, ask some of the following questions. How can we describe spoken language? Which feature of comprehensible input should we encourage learners to notice? What sort of speaking opportunities should we create in classrooms? And how can we best research learners' spoken output? And research may well provide some of the answers here. And Sue has already introduced this definition of action research by Elliot as the study of a social situation with a view to improving the quality of the action within it. And McNeill points out that applied to classrooms, action research is an approach to improving education through change by encouraging teachers to be aware of their own practice, to be critical of that practice, and to be prepared to change it. And the next quote also focuses on the concept of change and states that action research is primarily concerned with change, being grounded in the idea that development and innovation are an essential part of professional practice. And the stages of action research consist of cyclical process of action, observation, planning, and reflection, and this in turn may then lead to further action depending on the outcomes. In terms of the research projects that you will be doing for the assignments, you may find the stages proposed by Strickland to be helpful. And the first one is to identify an issue, an interest, or a problem. So it may just be something that you're curious about. It doesn't have to be a problem. It could equally well be a desire to investigate something that works well and wanting to find out why it works well. And a useful next step then would be to seek knowledge about a particular issue. And this is where you turn to the literature to see what is already known or what has already been written about it. And you can then plan an action. And here you decide how you're going to investigate the issue. Do you want, for example, to introduce a new technique? And if so, how are you going to go about it? And the next stage is to observe the action. But for the purposes of the assignment, you will usually need to do more than just observe. You will need, in other words, to collect data in some form, which in turn will form the basis for the next step, which is to reflect on the observations. And this will include then a careful analysis and evaluation of the data you've collected. And as a result of what you find there, you may then want to revise the original plan. Or, in terms of the assignment, you may want to make suggestions for further research. You will certainly have the opportunity to explore your own classroom experiences in depth when it comes to doing your assignments, because they will be based on classroom issues that you have identified as being significant in your context, and they will form the basis for specific research projects. And this approach to assessment means that while there are still constraints on what can be submitted in terms of word length and general academic requirements, you are free to choose topics which are of direct relevance to you. And the consequent investigations which you conduct are likely to lead to new insights into your approach to teaching, likely to benefit your learners and possibly colleagues, and quite often they lead to an increase in professional confidence and competence. Many of the units contain either examples of or suggestions for research which can be conducted as a basis for the assessed assignment. What's important is to find a focus which is sufficiently narrow and sufficiently well defined to be able to subject it to fairly close scrutiny. And I'll give you a few examples of recent MET assignments to illustrate this and to show the wide range of very interesting research projects which participants produce. And the first one of these was titled Developing Focus on Form Methods in the Task-Based Teaching Cycle. And this research took place in an EAP context and looked at the effects of a number of different techniques to raise student awareness of specific language features and used, for example, techniques like input flooding and consciousness raising. The next assignment, I think, raised a very interesting question. Does allowing learners to nominate and negotiate topics during speaking practice produce interaction that greater resembles conversation? Now, trying to get learners to communicate in a natural manner is something that a lot of teachers work very hard to try to help them achieve. And the activities which were introduced and evaluated in this assignment seemed to help, and what was analysed specifically there were the features such as the length of turn, of different turns, and how learners introduced new topics into the conversations they had. And the final assignment title was The Effect of Phonics Instruction on a Group of Arab Young Learners' Spelling of Letters and Monosyllabic Words. And I think that the title of this assignment shows very effectively how narrow and how well-defined the focus for the research project is. And it's quite clear that it's a particular type of teaching activity that's involved, Phoenix instruction, and that the impact or the effect of which he's investigated is limited to changes in learners' spelling of letters and monosyllabic words. And the other thing that's very clear here is the context, that the focus is on young learners and on Arab speakers. So I'm very happy to report that all the research mentioned here had very positive outcomes and led to new insights for these teachers. So, in this brief introduction, I've tried to give you a flavour of the complex, changing and very fascinating world of English language teaching methodology, together with an overview of the contents of the MET module, and an idea, I hope, of the sort of investigations of your own practice which you can expect to be involved in. And I'll leave you with a quote which I think puts a very positive spin on how teachers can influence future developments of ELT. The implications and consequences of adopting new approaches to ELT will be shaped by the use teachers and learners make of them in the classrooms. Thank you and goodbye for now.